We have an interesting topic this morning. Can you change your destiny? It's an important point to remember that in fact we have, all of us, only one absolute destiny. And that is that we've come from God and we have to go back to Him. It's curious that it's exactly the opposite statement of what you're likely to hear in every church in the West. But as Yogananda said, Christ was crucified once, and His teachings have been crucified every day since then. There are certain misunderstandings that have come into religion, and one of the most heinous of these is the thought that we are by nature damned, and that only by accepting Christ on the cross, Christ crucified, can we be saved. The disciples of Christ were surely saved before the crucifixion. John the Baptist died before Christ was crucified. Surely he was saved. Not only that, but what are you saved from when they speak of being saved? Saved from a fate much worse than death, literally, after death, or saved from something that you can see right here and right now. I'm reminded of a story that happened to Yogananda many years ago, and he was going to a lecture, and he was dressed in an orange robe, which he didn't normally wear in the streets, but because of going to a lecture, he was dressed for the lecture. And he had his hair down long, and there was this Orthodox fundamentalist preacher who was storming up and down the aisle, sort of looking like this and then looking like this, and finally turned on him and he said, "Are you a Christian?" And Yogananda said, "Yes." He said, "Do you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior?" And Yogananda said, "Well, I accept God as my Savior, and I believe that God has effected His salvation through Jesus as well as through others." "Unless you accept Jesus Christ as your Savior, you will go to hell." And he said it with such anger. Of course, the whole carload of people were very interested in this conversation, and you could see in the man's face this contortion of rage. And Yogananda very calmly said, "Well, I may get there by and by, but my friend, you're there already." It was so patently true that everybody burst out laughing, because if there's any hell, it's the hell of harmful emotions, anger being an example, jealousy, greed, envy. These are the things that put us in hell. And they may be exaggerated after death for those who live that way, because there is a certain lid on our feelings as long as we're living in a physical body. When this weight of matter is taken off us, whatever feelings we have, whether negative or positive, become increased 1,000-fold. So that if you've been living in anger and hatred and so on, it may not be written on your face. It may not be something that you're as conscious of, although you know you're not happy. But later you know how very unhappy you were and are. Whereas if you feel joy now in your meditations, in serving other people and so on, once you die, that natural tendency is increased 1,000-fold, because the heart then is freer to express its own nature. There is indeed a hell. That hell is a state of consciousness. It's not a state imposed upon us. It's a state which we can get out of. And that's the important point to remember, that we are not naturally damned. We are naturally children of God. And we can live in such a way as to deny it or to affirm it. But to say that our nature, that by nature, just because of something some ancestor of ours did many, many thousands of years ago, namely Adam and Eve, listening to the wrong counsel of a serpent, just because of this faux pas of theirs, that we've all got to suffer and be damned, unless by good chance we happen to get the good word. It's every religion gathers around it certain myths, certain ideas, certain mental attitudes. Some of them are wholesome, some of them are not wholesome. I've mentioned to many of you an experience I had years ago in India, when I read the Indian scriptures and found that there was so much sentiment attached to the cow. I used to be sort of puzzled. It seemed to me that a cow was all right, as far as cows go, but I couldn't get myself worked up over them. And of course, in the original Sanskrit, the word cow is go, which also means light. And all those old Vedic poems that include mention of cows are really talking of light, the divine light. When you have a large herd of cows that you increase and make even larger, it means your aura is large and you'll make it even larger by your meditation, that the light in you will grow, and so on. This is the real meaning, a word that changed meaning and gradually lost its original meaning and became confused with some lower meaning. However, the sentiment of the Hindu toward the cow somewhat baffled me. I'll never forget this one man who, in his wife's presence, said that she was a cow in her last incarnation. And I looked at her, and she was sort of looking like this. I thought, maybe he's right. But anyway, I remember going into somebody's home one day and his describing this pet cow that they had in their back yard. And he talked with such love that I began to tune into this mental picture that they had formed, that became real to them. You see, there are certain images that we create, and they become sort of racial images even. It's an idea that everybody tunes into to a certain extent. It's why people of one country can't always appreciate the jokes of another country, because they have different mental images. Once you tune into the image, suddenly you understand the joke. It isn't that other people don't have a sense of humor, it's that their agreed on values and ideas are similar. And ours are similar among ourselves. So we'll tell jokes and lay ourselves out laughing, and foreigners will stare at us and wonder what's gotten into us. And so he had this mental image that was sufficiently strong in his mind that I could begin to tune into it. And he talked about how his wife would go out and feed this cow, and the cow, with great love and gratitude, would say, "Ma." And I, on the one hand, was so amused, and on the other hand, suddenly began to understand this idea. The cow, really, for the Hindu, is sort of a reflection of the Hindu's general attitude toward life. Reminiscent and gentle and sort of quiet and forgiving and just giving of herself and so on. This is the mental attitude that the Hindus like, and the Westerners, of course, like dogs for reasons that the dog reflects who Americans are, particularly running in circles and all sorts of enthusiasm for nobody knows quite what, friendly toward everybody without any discrimination. In many ways, you can see why Americans like dogs. And so it is that in religion, there are indeed certain mental attitudes that are formed, and they aren't necessarily true. They're the body of mythology that grows up around a central teaching, which in time becomes confused for that teaching. So that if people, I can imagine Christ coming back here today and talking and no doubt singing in one of our churches today, not known as Christ, but just doing what he did in his time. And the people in the church is saying, "Well, wait a minute, we're Christians, we don't want this." Why? Because we've built up a great body of stuff that has nothing to do with his original message. His original message, for one thing, was a very austere one. It was built for his times. It isn't as if saints living today would have to live the way he lived. But he didn't have anywhere to live. He would sleep under trees. He would go from house to house. He would never take money with him. He didn't and urged people not to think about tomorrow. According to his to a more rigid viewpoint of his teaching, you would have to say that borrowing money was not Christian. You would have to say that a great many things that we do are not Christian, even if they don't seem all that bad. Not to speak of the many things we do that aren't good. But we must understand that the ideas that have been built up by theologians, this one, for example, of our being naturally damned until we accept Christ's blood on the cross. Somebody said to Yogananda once that he must be saved by the blood, and he said, well, produce a quart. And she didn't know what to do. Because, in fact, what do you do about it? If you start getting very literal, the idea of Christ's body and blood that we have to take at Mass every time we go to church is dreadfully cannibalistic. I mean, if you literally had Christ lying on the ground here, who among all Christians would dream of suddenly swooping down and starting gnawing away? It's unthinkable. It's a symbol. It's not the literal reality. It's a symbol of something much, much deeper. It isn't wrong, but we must understand the extent to which the symbol often gets in the way of the reality. And so the idea that we are naturally damned is really an extension of the fact that we are unnaturally damned. And that's the truth, in a sense, that we are unnaturally wedded to a state of consciousness that isn't our own. We are wedded to the idea that we are ego and body and all the things that keep people from realizing who they really are, which is children of God. But if that's what we really are, then it's just altogether too sordid a view of God's creation, that he could allow a whole planet of people, or possibly a whole universe of his children, to be damned by nature until they happen on the right key, let's say. And until then, all those sincere Buddhists and sincere Hindus and sincere Muslims who are trying their best but somehow haven't got the word straight, they're all damned. It doesn't make sense at all. It's a gruesome picture of reality. The reality is, in fact, what Jesus was saying, that he came here to show us what we might be. When the Jews criticized him, accused him of blaspheming, because he said, I and my Father are one, his answer was, don't the scriptures say you are gods? And then he went on to say that he made the difference between sleeping gods and waking gods, in effect. He said that him who the Father hath sanctified, that is to say, one who has realized that he is a son of God, one who has realized who he really is, then he has a right to really say it. But everybody has that potential. He didn't come here to tell us what we weren't, but what he was, as if to sort of reinforce our misfortune. He came to show us what we might become. He came to show us that we can become everything that he was. And he said that himself. The things that I do, you shall do, and greater things, for I go to my Father. It's a misunderstanding. It's a misconception. It's not a true Christian teaching. It's a teaching sort of gradually brought into being by little extensions of a single thought to say that we are by nature damned. It's sort of like trying to tune a piano by always referring back to the note before and to no other note. So you tune the D to the C, and then you tune the E to the D, and the F to the E, and you go on up the scale, and there are little tiny, every time you tune it, there are little tiny variations that the ear can't hear. But by the time you've gone a couple of scales, you're pretty well off. That's why a piano tuner has to constantly refer back to other notes and get an overall picture. And so with theology and with the mythology that builds up around religion, what you get is a central teaching, and then somebody encloses it in a certain form in order to give it more clarity to the mind. And he makes a statement that may help to resolve a certain conflict, a certain doubt, whatever it might be. And then the next generation of writers and theologians and teachers and so on take that and they build on it. And they keep building on it and building on it. Yogananda himself said that how you all will change my teachings. I just wonder if I came back 100 years from now, whether I would even recognize them. We're all trying our best, but it's just impossible to constantly, it's not even necessarily always right, because times change and different emphases have to be given. But remember that the things that people say that try to emphasize your destiny as anything other than absolute oneness with God, they don't have the backing of the great saints and masters of the different religions. They have the backing only of a bunch of theologians, people who have intellectualized themselves into a corner or out on a limb or anyway very far from the central reality of it all. It's sort of like when you go to an art gallery. If you haven't been to art school, you will see that there are certain paintings that you just instinctively love and others that you think are ugly. You feel, I don't want to live with that. This painting here is of a person who's totally insane. Why would I want that in my house? I'm trying to get sane enough myself. This is a picture of a person who has no peace of mind, no harmony. Why would I want him looking at me every day from my living room wall? And you have an automatic feeling that is very likely true, at least for where you are right then. But somebody who's been to art school will be able to go into that same gallery and tell you all the reasons why the worst of those paintings is the best, and why the best of them may be merely sentimental. And you can use the mind to completely confuse your heart's instinctive understanding. That's why with any new teaching, new idea, I always try to refer it back to like a piano tuner, not just to the note before, but to all that I know, all that has been said, all that the traditions of the ages have given. I always try to refer it back to that. If it won't stand up to that test, then I'm not going to be snowed by a good line of logic, because logic can be used in many ways and very often is used in wrong ways. People have used logic that at least convinced their listeners to commit crimes, to commit terrible acts in the name of civilization or progress or eugenics or God knows what else. No, always go back to the origin, to the real teachers, to those people who have had the experience and not merely intellectualized themselves, as I said, out on a limb. If we see that, then we see that there is only one absolute destiny for all of us, and it's one you can't escape. You can't escape your destiny to ultimately become one with God. You were put in this world, as St. Augustine said, Father, thou hast made us for thyself, and our hearts are restless till they find their rest in thee. All men are that. All men have to achieve that. There isn't any other destiny that's absolute. That destiny can be deferred, delayed indefinitely, but it can't be changed in the last analysis, because you can't get away from who you really are. Everything outside of God is not who you really are. Everything outside of God is a delusive self that you have managed to convince yourself of. And you have to use your various delusions in order to overcome the worst of them. For instance, the delusion of being kind is still a delusion in the sense that who is to be kind to whom? There's nothing but the infinite goodness. And when you have that consciousness, goodness flows through you even without your thinking about, I am being good. It just happens. Just in your presence, without even putting your mind to it, nice things come about. But being good deliberately is certainly a way of overcoming the tendency to be bad. So dream in the right way if you want to change dreaming in the wrong way. In this sense, destiny can definitely be changed. There isn't any destiny outside of that ultimate one that can't be changed. We must understand that there isn't destiny in the normal fixed sense that God wills that such and such things come about. There's only one thing that he wills for us all, and everything else is relative to that ultimate will, and that is that we know him, that we love him, that we surrender to his will, that we open our hearts to his love, that we unite ourselves with him. Anything can be called his will that takes us in that direction much more clearly than anything else, but there certainly is not a destiny as such that the moving finger writes and having writ moves on, kind of here is the infinite judge saying this. No, it's all a dream. And what makes anything happen is what you see making things happen right now. What is that? Application, energy, concentration. It always amounts to when you put out enough energy. Somebody was asking me about the design for my pool yesterday, and he was saying, well, did you spend a long time, months, thinking about it? And I said, well, I thought about it for a while, but I didn't really put my mind to it until the day before I had to have the answer. And then I went into meditation. I put a lot of energy into asking for a design for the garden, and then suddenly it came very clearly. And I was saying, what you need is to understand that it's the kind of energy you put out, not the time you spend. You can get an answer, you can see a way through to the solution of a problem or whatever it might be, always in terms not of time, but of energy. You can get it in 1 minute, and another person might take weeks or months, because you're putting out in 1 minute the same amount of energy as that person puts out over weeks and months. In fact, you can do it often better quickly if you put out a really crystal stream of energy, because when you're putting out that energy over a long period of time, it very often gets frittered away. You're thinking about it, and then you get pulled off onto some other subject, and that energy dies down, and you have to pick it up every time you come back to it. And because the energy at each time is not very strong energy, it's usually not from a superconscious level, but more on a worry level, which is the conscious level. And as long as you're on a worry level, all you see is problems. You don't see solutions. So in fact, very often you'll get a much better answer to things if you put out enough energy to get it now, as opposed to thinking, well, let's take our time. You might find that it takes a very long time to come up with what is, in the end, essentially a very mediocre answer, because it's never been that level of energy that would lift it to a higher level of inspiration. At any rate, we must say that all destiny is the result of the kind of energy that you have put out. That when you accomplish anything in this world, you set into motion a certain quality as well as degree or quantity of energy. We must then also see this world in a very different way from the way we're normally inclined to see it, because what we usually see is form, substance, matter, this separate from that, this problem requiring all these other solutions in order to come about. And in reality, the world is very different from the way these eyes show it to us. Science has shown us a world which yogis said many thousands of years ago it was, a world composed essentially of energy, not matter. And science tells us today, in fact, that matter is energy. Yogis have gone a step further. They have said that energy is really only a condensation of thought. And thought is a condensation of consciousness. Consciousness, willpower, acting upon energy, manifesting energy through the agency of willpower, and then that energy being directed toward things. And if you can have enough of that energy, you can accomplish very quickly things that other people might take a long time accomplishing. This is the cornerstone of our teachings. Master taught the energization exercises to give us the awareness of ourselves as energy. When we see ourselves as energy, we can direct the energy not only to the body, but also outside the body to whatever particular objective we set for ourselves. Now, anything that comes to you is the result of energy set into motion already. Mostly by you, but no, not entirely. There is mass karma too. And when we speak of energy, we're speaking of it in the context of karma. Mass karma is the energy set out by a group of people. It could be a family, it could be a town, a community, it could be a whole nation, it could be a whole planet. But this energy is a very important part of what happens to people. People asked Master one time if Hitler would have to suffer for many, many incarnations because of the way he behaved. And Yogananda replied, he certainly will have to suffer, but don't think that his karma is only his own. The karma is the karma of the people, because he was acting on behalf of the people. When we dropped the atom bomb on Hiroshima, that's the karma of America. It's not just the karma of President Truman. And we have to pay for that. When we treated the American Indians the way we did, when we treated the black slaves the way we did, this is a karma the whole country has to work off in some way. Fortunately, he said that we have also very good karma to balance that off. And this is the next side to understand, that whatever karma you have, if you also work, don't worry about the bad karma, work to develop good karma. This is why it's very important to act for God, to act in good ways, to not worry about whatever has happened before. As Sri Yukteswar said, forget the past. The past lives of all men are dark with many shames, but everything in future will improve if you are making the right spiritual effort now. You can't unmake an energy nearly so easily as you can redirect a new flow of energy that will offset the old. Let's say that you've got a lot of energy moving in this direction, and it's an energy toward darkness. And suddenly you put out a lot of energy here. If this energy is stronger, you no longer get pulled that way, you get pulled this way. And that darkness becomes transmuted, and it finally becomes transformed into light itself. That there isn't any black energy that can't be converted into light energy. It depends on energy itself. How much energy you put out, how much concentrated energy, and this all comes back to willpower. Yogananda said, the greater the will, the greater the flow of energy. And so when your willpower is strong to do the right thing, there's the marvelous story of Milarepa. I don't know how many of you have read that book, but it's well worth reading. It's Tibet's greatest yogi. He lived a few hundred years ago. And his mother had been cheated after her husband's death, cheated out of her inheritance by unscrupulous relatives. And she was unable to forgive and helpless as a woman to revenge. And so she counted on her son, Milarepa, to revenge her. And out of a misplaced sense of filial loyalty and devotion, he went out and learned the arts of black magic. And through the arts of black magic, he created a little form in the shape of those relatives' fields, and was able, by incantations over this plan, to bring a hailstorm that destroyed all her crops. And then by black magic he was able to materialize all sorts of poisonous insects and snakes and so on that killed all those relatives. And it was after killing, I think, 33 of these relatives that he suddenly woke up to what a great sin he had committed, and that he had to bear the burden of that, even though he was doing it for his mother, out of love for his mother. And he realized that inevitably he would have to suffer for many lifetimes because of what he'd done. And so he tried to find a saint who would help him to overcome in one lifetime all that bad karma. Now, mind you, most people simply would have gone ahead and suffered all those lifetimes. It was not an inevitable destiny, however, that he do so. Nor was it an inevitable destiny that he not do so. You must remember that too. It was up to his free choice. We have a certain amount of free choice. We'll come back to that because it's a very difficult subject in itself. But he found a guru who knew yoga, and he asked him to initiate him into this yoga. The guru said yes, he would be able to free him in one lifetime from this karma, but he must be a true and obedient disciple and do everything that he said. And so Milarepa said, all right, I will. And Guru Marpa wouldn't initiate him at first. He told him that he needed a house built up there on that hill in stone. And Milarepa, a young man, strong, but nevertheless, this was quite punishment for his body, had to roll heavy stones up that hill to put up that building. And he had it just about finished when the guru came over and saw it and said, this isn't the hill I told you to put it on. I told you to put it on that hill, way at the other side of his large property. And so Milarepa took all the stones down and rolled them over to that hill, finally had the house almost built. And his guru came over and saw it. He said, I didn't tell you to put it there. And Milarepa said, I very clearly remember, sir, that you did. I must have been drunk, said the guru. I didn't want it there. I wanted it here. Anyway, all this time, people would come and get initiation and leave. And Milarepa was just there like the sort of a slave doing all this work. And he was getting more and more discouraged every time that he was told that he had to start all over again. He would just fall into the pits of the blackest despair. And finally, after he had finally given up, his guru called him. After a long time of this outrageous discipline, his guru called him and said, such was your karma that you had to fall into complete despair 8 times before you could be free from the burden of it. Now you're fit to be initiated. And so he did initiate him, and Milarepa went and meditated in a cave for many years and became the greatest yogi Tibet has known. Remember that. Remember also what the Bhagavad Gita says. 2 very important things. 1, that even the worst of sinners, if he will steadfastly meditate, quickly can find me. And 2, even a little bit of the practice of this religion, that is to say, this inner religion, as opposed to mere outward ritual, this inner religion of yoga, of communion with God inwardly, of lifting the consciousness up into superconsciousness. Even a little bit of the practice of this religion will free you from dire fears and colossal sufferings. Why? Because you'll be generating a new kind of energy. In fact, that energy will create an aura, a magnetic field of that we call the aura around your body, through which negative destinies, negative karmas won't be able to penetrate. There isn't anything that you need fear. There is a story in the life of Jim Corbett, who hunted the man-eaters of Kumaon and killed several man-eating leopards, tigers, etc., and freed many hill stations in India of a terrible curse in the process. He talked about one leopard that was a man-eater, and this leopard was very intelligent, very agile, and it would get up on the roof of a house and pull off a corner of the roof and in this way get into the house and take people away and eat them. And the villagers had reached such a point of panic that they were convinced that this was an evil demon and that they were absolutely powerless in the face of it. And knowing that that leopard was coming, clawing its way through the roof, they would often just in rigid paralysis of fear not be able to do anything about it. The leopard was just able to take its pick. And Jim Corbett was able to kill it finally. But the thing is that fear paralyzes people and they become so rigid, so rigid in their fear that they think, well, there's nothing I can do about it, I just have to give in. And a lot of people, unfortunately, faced with adversity, faced with a long string of misfortune, end up thinking, well, it's my destiny, I can't help myself. It isn't true. The strongest destiny can be changed. Yogananda talked of the life of Judas. He said Judas had a very strong karma. to betray. It was almost inevitable because the karma was so strong, but even so, he could have changed it if he had willed to do so. He could have... Karma can be changed. If you understand that the way that it was formed in the first place was by your own energy. Unfortunately, your energy attracts other energy. It isn't only that you're living in a vacuum. That whatever energy you put out, it's sort of like a sounding board. It comes back to you. It's like the guitar strings. When you have the guitar underneath it, whatever string you pluck is reinforced by the sound of the sounding board. And so whatever kind of energy you put out, the universe resounds to that and reinforces it. And that's what makes it so much harder. We feel ourselves almost engulfed in whatever is happening to us. In fact, there are times when no matter what you do, it seems to make it worse. I'm thinking of the time when I was in trouble with SRF. I was doing what to me was not only a good thing, but the only right thing to do. It just seemed a marvelous choice. I had Diamata's backing. Everything seemed fine. And suddenly the roof caved in on me, and everybody began to think that I was trying to destroy the work and divide the work. And I was just completely stunned with this interpretation. And I found that no matter what I did, I was entangled. No matter what I did, if I Diamata urged me not to say or do anything for a while because it would be a cause for misinterpretation. So I tried saying and doing nothing, and people were saying I was saying and doing nothing, and therefore I was boycotting. And so then I tried to do a little bit, and I got it from the neck from the other side, and it was just amazing how many little things came just at that time of the same type. For example, there was an article that Abhedananda, who is one of the monks in SRF, had written on Hatha Yoga, on the firm pose. And he called it the diamond pose because diamond is a hard material. But I printed his article and I changed the word from diamond to adamantine. Now I've changed it to firm because that's what's really meant by it. But he wrote me this stinging letter about how had I dared changed his title, and everybody seemed to have something to say against me, and nobody had anything to say for me. And there wasn't anything that I could do or not do, say or not say, that didn't seem to make it all the worse. From complete strangers, people who didn't know anything about me. It just was my karma. It was something that I was emanating at that time, unconsciously to be sure, and coming back to me. Well, how do you change things like that? We all go through periods when somehow, no matter what we seem to be able to do, seems to come back on us. Well, I think that the best thing to do in such cases is to simply change our sounding board. I was trying to work it out by relate better to these people so they'd understand why I was trying to do it, so they'd appreciate and work with me so that they could correct me in such a way that I could change if I had to change. But I was working on this level, and the sounding board was already coming back to me according to a string I had plucked who knows how many lifetimes before. What I needed to do and didn't realize at the time was simply change my sounding board. I've seen this now that I look back and study the lives of saints, that they have managed to by not relating to that sounding board at all, suddenly it ceases to exist and some great sweetness comes out instead. This one man who was a very saintly man was mistaken for a criminal of some sort and hailed into court, and he paid no attention. He just thought, all right, never mind, if they want to take me to court, fine. I think he probably looked like some criminal that they were out for. And so he was brought before the judge, and the judge asked him what he was doing there, and the man said, well, I don't really know, Your Honor. By God's grace, I was walking down the street, and by God's grace, this policeman picked me up, and by God's grace, he brought me here, and by God's grace, I'm before you. And if by God's grace you want to put me in prison, fine, and if by God's grace you want to release me, fine. But he wasn't relating to what had happened at all. He was just saying, it's all God's grace, it doesn't matter. And the judge said, well, he could see the man was just obviously innocent, so he let him go. He wasn't relating. When you don't relate to other people's realities, then suddenly you find that you've got a new sounding board, and that sounding board can give you a different reality. It's interesting to me to see how many mafiosi waste their time killing each other. How many drug people are just constantly fighting each other. And others don't even know they exist. It's another world altogether. You have your own sounding board that you're working from. So remember that your influence is, indeed, you're the start of whatever energy goes out, but whatever energy you put out becomes an influencing energy too. Whether it's your family, whether it's your friends, whether it's your country, God is on the right side, Satan is on the left side, and you are in between. And neither one will influence you, and all their ramifications of ways in which they could influence you, levels from which they can influence you, none of them are pulling you, but you put one step to the right, and then godly influences will take you further to the right. And as you keep going more and more in tune with them, those influences become stronger and stronger. And those are the powers. That's the power of grace, which finally saves you. You don't do it yourself, but you put your will in tune with that. And then you find that as you resonate with it, you're able to give yourself more and more to it until finally you become that. And on the other hand, if you choose ego, greed, selfishness, if you go in a negative direction, you find that that becomes the power that influences you, and you see all the reasons in the world why you should be that way. Worldly people who are full of demonic qualities or merely delusive qualities of selfishness and so on, these people see all the reasons in the world why they should be the way they are, because they get back a new kind of sounding board, something that reinforces their will in a negative way. Some people are bound for destruction. You can see it in the way in their faces. You can see how quickly they seem to be descending the scale of evolution. The difference between man and the animals is that the animal has no choice. He's brought gradually, if slowly, upward. But once you reach the human level, there is that germ. Often it's not much more than a germ, but it's enough to get started. It's enough that you take a tiny move in either direction for the doors gradually to open in that direction. And so you see that man, because he has this degree of free will, is able greatly to increase his evolution or, in fact, to go backwards. Man has the power to ascend or descend the ladder of evolution. So then, remember that it isn't just your will that will accomplish what you're trying to accomplish. You don't have to do very much even. What you really have to do is to refine or raise the level of your will, the level of your consciousness, so that you're working from, or at least toward, attuning yourself with that level of sounding board, that level of energy and consciousness that you want to assist you. You can't do more on your own. You can't. It's absolutely impossible to achieve these things just by your willpower. You must understand that even if you're not aware of it, any direction of willpower will attune you to a larger reality, which in turn will influence you. Habit will influence you. The mass consciousness will influence you. Many things will influence you. Thus, the importance of choosing your sounding boards. That's the importance, the absolute importance, if you want to get out of negativity, of not mixing with negative people. If you want to get out of failure consciousness, don't mix with people who have failure consciousness. Mix with people who have success consciousness. If you want to find God, mix with people who also want to find God. Don't waste your time and energy mixing with people who offer you another kind of sounding board. It's all very well to try to help them, but you need some strength yourself. You need some place to get back to, a community of people, a group of friends, whatever it might be, who can reinforce what you're trying to do. don't, in the name of friendship, hang on to those kinds of so-called friends who are harmful to what you're trying to do with your life. Put them on a shelf. You don't have to betray your loyalty to them. Put them mentally on a shelf and say, I'll come back to you when I'm strong enough to help you. But don't feel that because you've known them all your life, therefore you've got to hobnob with people who have no interest in spiritual things if your desire is to grow spiritually. If you want to overcome alcoholism, don't mix with alcoholics. Mix with people who don't drink, and then it'll gradually become an unheard-of thing for you to drink. You just wouldn't think of it anymore. But as long as you're mixing with other people who drink, it will seem like a very strange thing to be doing, to give up drinking. Environment, in this sense, is stronger than willpower. And if we recognize the reality of that, then we can use it to our own greatest advantage and our own greatest strength and inner freedom. But if we deny reality in the name of some wishful thought, then we're not going to get very far. We must understand above all the importance of two things, the guru and the grace of God. The guru is simply the objectified manifestation of God's grace. The guru is there when you're ready for the guru. He is there to take you further into the inner realms. And to adjust yourself to his consciousness makes it possible to change even radical destinies. I've been very interested to see how many astrologers who have been, actually they've been quite very good astrologers, some of them, not all, and they've all agreed on certain things in my horoscope, and yet those things haven't come true. Because I have a guru, because that guru changes these things. Sister Gyanamata's destiny was to die, and Yogananda said, I made a pact with God that she wouldn't go until I said yes. And that happened for 20, 25 years until finally he prayed for her release, and then she was released. Sister Mira Mata, she was to die, and Yogananda kept her in the body for many years so she could serve God's work. There were many things that he did with people's lives. I remember this one man that I mentioned in my book, The Path, the brother of Jean Haupt Richard, who, although a competent businessman, was always failing. That is to say, he seemed competent, he knew all the rules, he put out a lot of energy, but nothing he ever do seemed to work. And Yogananda de-jinxed him, which is to say, he helped his consciousness to overcome whatever it was that was attracting failure, and to get him into a positive way of thinking, a positive way of working, and suddenly the man was successful. A lot of our success depends strictly on some little thought that we need to have in order to see things clearly. We need to be able to visualize. If you want to change your destiny, you must have a very clear mental picture of what it is you're trying to achieve. I don't say you must. I'm wrong in saying you must. There must be a very clear mental picture of something. It may not be the thing you're trying to achieve. It may be the kind of energy that you're putting out that you trust will eventually arrive at fulfillment. But it must be a very clear mental image of where your energies shall go and how. And then you will see that the greatest difficulties in your life, the worst periods in your horoscope. Yogananda was, remember he said that he was to be married 3 times, and because he chose not to be, he wasn't. He had a very clear image of what it was that he wanted, and he simply didn't accept any other. I remember years ago at the beginning of Ananda, we had lots and lots of difficulties getting started, financial and otherwise. And I was living in a small house in Sacramento and going around teaching classes every night to raise the funds to help pay off the mortgage here. And I was generating quite a lot of money when suddenly I got a letter from the trustees of the property saying that if we didn't pay back payments, which we hadn't paid because the roads hadn't yet been finished, and they said that you're powerless, even if we don't finish the roads, if you don't pay that all that back money within 2 weeks, we'll foreclose on you. All that amount, which was $4,500, in addition to the monthly payments, and I was doing it all single-handed. And I remember what a shock that was when I got this letter after class in Sacramento one evening. Friends of mine, seeing me, said, "Well, come home and we'll have some tea, and you'll feel better." I said, "Listen, I'm not trying to feel better. I'm trying to think, what can I do about it?" And I remember driving home just shaking like this. I just had to have a solution. And so they managed to defer it till June 1st. I got the check in the mail for the last of the payments May 30th. That's how close it was. I managed to move up here, and on July 3rd, just 1 month later, our temple burned to the ground. And there were all sorts of things that went wrong that year. And I remember talking a few months later to a friend of mine, and we were talking about people's misfortunes and so on. I said, "You know, it's funny, but I never seem to have any misfortunes. Everything seems to go smoothly." And she said, "Smoothly, my God!" And she started listing all these things that had happened. And I said, "Oh, yeah, I guess that's true." But, you know, you don't have to accept those as misfortunes. You don't have to accept that things are bad. Just keep your mind going where you have to go, and you'll find that then things work out. Whereas many people allow themselves to be sucked under by some toothache or something. It's just amazing the things that people will live on and feed on for years afterwards. Some woman came to Yogananda and was talking about an operation that she had had, and she gave it in harrowing detail, and how she had suffered and everything. And he said, when did you have this operation? She seemed pretty perfectly ambulatory by this point. And she said, 20 years ago. He said, 20 years and you've been operated on every day since then? The thing is that we must stop living on that level, which will reinforce negativity. We've got to try to keep our minds on that level that will reinforce the positive side. If you have a bad period in your horoscope, if you have a bad period in your life, then just say, "Well, never mind. I'm a child of God, and I know it's all a dream anyway, and I'll just live in Him." You'll find that if you have that kind of attitude, that bit by bit, this negative force field that was built up from the past, that is reinforcing whatever energy you put out in the first place, will slowly disintegrate. It's all just reflections in a pond anyway. It really is. This whole world is nothing but a dream. And so if we can learn to tune in to the right one for us, then suddenly everything comes crystal clear, everything is smooth, everything is easy. Yes, you can change your destiny. There are, however, and this is the point that you must realize, there are many different qualities of destiny. And destiny isn't just an abstraction. Some destinies are very strong. Others are not all that strong, and you don't know how strong any one of them is, really, because it's sort of like a nail in a board. You know that to get the nail out of the board, you have to keep pulling with your hammer, with the nail puller. But you don't know how long you'll have to pull, because you don't know how much nail there is in the board to pull out. It's only when it's finally out that you can say, "Well, I've done it." Until then, you can only say, "I know that in order to get it out, I have to keep trying." And so it is that on the path, you don't know how long it's going to take you to find God. You don't know how long it's going to take you to work out all the karmas that you have generated that keep you from realizing Him. But you do know that the more you keep trying, the more bit by bit this great and glorious destiny, the only absolute destiny you have, will be fulfilled. And when you go through hard times, when things are somehow the world seems to be against you and nothing's going right, it isn't necessarily at all anything that you have done at that time. It's just that this is a period in your life when that's to happen. when misunderstandings are to occur, when obstacles are to come. And it's not something that you have done in that moment. It's certainly something you've done at some time. But the answer isn't to go to some life reader who tells you what you did in your last life that reinforces that thought, possibly. The answer is to get into God. That's why Lahiri Mahashai gave what to many people would seem like a perfectly simplistic solution to everything. He said, do more kriyas. And yet it's the truth. Because you don't need to worry about this. It will go on as it will go on. But if you can get up to another level, suddenly everything will change. Everything will work as it ought to work. Don't worry about the bad things that happen. Remember that it always depends upon the amount, the degree, the focus of right kind of energy that you put out. But more than that, it depends upon that sounding board. Get in tune. Master said you all will have lots of troubles after I'm gone. But they won't. They needn't be if you stay in tune. Whenever things get bad, get more in tune. And you will find that in that attunement, everything will start to go well. This is why when we had this fire here, and it destroyed so many of our homes, such a wonderful thing it was to see how people all pitched in. And joyfully, we have that wonderful picture of Asha smiling happily as she's clearing away all the burnt and charred remains of a home so that we could rebuild again. This kind of attitude, the idea that we put out of not wanting to take it out on our neighbors, on our fellow citizens of Nevada County, which we could have done because it was a county vehicle that was responsible for the fire. We could conceivably have sued and gotten $2 million, and that would have been enough to build Ananda. Conceivably, we could have done it. The average person would think us foolish for not doing so. But the law of karma worked because we didn't. Because we said, no, we don't want to take our bad luck out on others. It's our karma, not their karma. If you keep trying to blame other people, change other people, make them treat you right, you'll find that you never get out of it. All you're doing is really concentrating on that sounding board, which you started in the first place, which will give you back again and again what it is that you've been putting out. So you get this person to stop misunderstanding you, and you get that person to stop treating you badly, and you get the other person to start behaving somewhat decently for a change toward you, and you think, at last, and suddenly they're coming in from the back door. Because you're the one who started it, and they're just being sounding boards, and you're reinforcing that sounding board by relating to your problems on that problem level. Whereas if you just ignore all of that and just put your mind more in God, you'll suddenly find that they change without knowing why. Or if they don't change, they walk on and somebody else comes on stage. The whole scene shifts. Everything changes. Everything will improve if you make the right spiritual effort now. So instead of thinking, well, I must do this, that, and the other thing, I must appease Mrs. Jones, butter up Mr. Smith, and somehow get even with Mr. Green, and all these various things, and I've got to work this out and that out, and then finally maybe I can... Don't worry that way. Say, what can I do in order to change my life? I know that it requires energy. I know that it requires the right kind of energy directed toward the right level of consciousness. Energy directed upward, not merely outward. It's not a blocking energy that we're talking about. It's more that can help sometimes, but it doesn't seem to work all that well. The best thing is to use that energy to lift your consciousness to another way of looking at things. That if you... I remember years ago, this is not to my credit at all, perhaps I shouldn't tell it, but this is back when I was in college and was absolutely stone drunk. And I don't know why I managed to get that drunk, but I did. And... it was a period in my life when I thought drinking was fine and there was nothing wrong with it. And so I had a lot of compassion in my heart, and I saw this man there, and I just with great compassion was saying to him, but you can't be happy with a face like that. I felt so terribly sorry for the poor man. And he, of course, was getting more and more furious with me. actually, what I was trying to say was not that he was ugly, but that unhappiness was written on his face. But not being altogether sober, I didn't quite say it right. And he reached the point where he just felt that there was only one thing really worthwhile in life, and that was to smash me in the mazzard. You know, he couldn't do it. He just couldn't do it because I had so much real compassion. I was just feeling such love for him and wishing him happiness. And although he was furious, he couldn't touch me. You'll find that if you put out love, even... I used to find that I could go unscathed in all sorts of situations just because I wasn't in a sort of a scathing frame of mind myself. And so people who are all out there eager to beat each other up and talk nastily and everything, I always sort of moved through as if nothing ever happened and nothing ever did happen. Because that was the kind of aura that I had around me. I loved people. I liked people. I felt there was goodness. And if they were not behaving right, it was really too bad and they ought to change. But I didn't judge them because of it. And so you will see that if you just put out a good vibration, if you put out a vibration that's on a certain level, then you'll find that you're just not up for grabs anymore. And if you are, it's because of some very strong karma, which you can change. No destiny is absolute. So use your energy to practice Kriya. Use your energy to be in places like this as often as you can. It's not enough just to come once a year. Come here frequently, because in a place like this with other devotees and high vibrations, they give you the power to withstand the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, as Shakespeare put it, when you're in the cities and in your work environment and so on. I'll never forget how one time, being very, very tired, I went into seclusion, but being so tired, I didn't meditate much. I slept most of the time. When I came back, I felt somewhat good, but after a week, I was just as tired as ever. The next time I had the time to go into seclusion, I slept for a couple of days to change gears, and then I meditated 8 hours a day. And I found that when I came back, I had such power that nothing could hold me back for many months. It took me a long time to even think of being tired again. And everything flowed better because my energy was right. When things don't flow well, it's because your energy isn't right. So remember, going off on a vacation is all very well, but when you come back, the benefits of the vacation very soon peter out, and you're left there just as harried as ever. Whereas if you go into a spiritual place, spend your time mixing with devotees, spend your time in touch with superconsciousness, spend your time meditating and chanting and being more God-conscious, you'll find that that power will surround you, so that wherever you go, you carry it with you, and the sounding board that you touch will give back to you a new kind of joy, a new kind of awareness, a new kind of success. The more you live in superconsciousness, the more nothing can touch you. Master told Dr. Lewis this once. He said, if you can remain in Om, nothing will be able to touch you. And Dr. Lewis told the story of how one time after this advice, he was out on, I think it was Nantucket Sound, and in a boat. And there came a freak storm, and it looked as if they would be capsized. And Dr. Lewis was holding down the tarpaulin over the opening so that the water wouldn't come in. And he just got very calm and looked into the inner light. And he suddenly felt this calmness coming over, and he knew that he was safe. And then when he reached shore and came home, when he reached shore, he found all his friends and wife and family and everybody out there just in an anguish of fear for what would happen to him, and so overwhelmed with relief to find that he had come back safe and sound. And as he walked in to his house, the telephone rang, and Yogananda was on the other end, and Yogananda said, "You came pretty near getting wet, didn't you, doctor?" And doctor thought, well, maybe somebody had phoned him, and so he said, "Yes, I did," but he didn't know quite how to respond. He didn't take it as any kind of ESP or anything. But later he heard that Yogananda hadn't had any phone call, but he had been reading a story of Joseph Conrad on the sea to somebody, and suddenly he put the book down and he started striding up and down. He said, "Doctor's in trouble, in serious trouble, I tell you," like this. So his mind was very much on helping him, but Doctor touched him in Om. If you can remain in Om, if you can remain in the consciousness of God, then you will find that you're in touch with a sounding board that will give you back an enormous power to help you in all difficulties. Nothing can touch you if you remain. I remember the first time that I really heard and sort of merged with a little bit the great sound of Om. And my thought at the time was that the whole world could just go up in flames and it wouldn't matter to me. I wouldn't be touched by it. You're just in an absolute security at that time. You know that nothing can touch you. You have to work out your karma, but when you work it out from that level, you can work it out very quickly. Whereas if you try to work it out only on this level, it takes a very long time. Therefore, it is that in order to work out our karma, the most important thing we want to do is get into Om. Get into God consciousness. Get into Christ consciousness. Be in tune with Guru and with God. And then we will see that from that level of superconsciousness, we can look back on this level of karma and work things out very quickly. Yogananda said that in ecstasy and superconsciousness, a great yogi may be able to work out an entire lifetime of karma in one meditation, because he's seeing it from a level of absolute impartiality. He's seeing it from a high level of God consciousness. He can look through all the things that he did in that lifetime and release them all, because he has the energy to do so, release all those actions into God, so they no longer cling to his consciousness as a memory. Oh, I was so-and-so. It's no longer I was so-and-so. This form did such-and-such. It no longer has the same meaning for you, and that karma is paid off. The way to get out of it more than any other, then, is to remain in God consciousness. One very curious thing he said in his Bhagavad Gita interpretations was that a great yogi can actually reincarnate in several bodies simultaneously to work out his karma more quickly. There are all sorts of strange things going on up there that we don't know about. But one thing is certain, that the higher the level of consciousness, the more quickly and the more completely you can deal with your so-called destiny and make it into what you choose that it shall be. You can't do it just by positive thinking. It's got to be something much more than that. There's the story of a Catholic, Baptist, and a Christian Scientist who all died and went to the other place. And they were trying to figure out how they ever got there. And the Catholic said, "Well, maybe I missed Mass one Sunday." And the Baptist said, "Well, maybe I wasn't totally immersed when they baptized me." They couldn't figure it out. They didn't seem to have done all that wrong. So then they turned to the Christian Scientist and they said, "But how come you're here?" And he said, "Oh, but I'm not." And this isn't enough. You can't merely, it's a good start, but you can't really accomplish things by affirmation alone. You can't just deny a reality. You have to put out sufficient quality energy to be able to overcome that which you are denying. If you walk in a field and aren't aware that there are potholes there, that doesn't prevent you from falling into the potholes. You're not pothole conscious, and yet there are all those potholes, and you fall into one of them if you get over it. Yogananda talked about being mosquito consciousness, being mosquito conscious, and that drawing mosquitoes. Remember in that chapter, Years in My Master's Hermitage, where Sri Yukteswar told him that the reason that he was bothered by mosquitoes was that he had mosquito consciousness. And so Yogananda learned to not have mosquito consciousness, and then mosquitoes didn't bother him. Now, I defy you, or perhaps I should say I challenge you, to try it. The first person who ever got bit by a mosquito, or the first time you ever got bitten by a mosquito as a child, you were not mosquito conscious. It was mosquitoes who made you mosquito consciousness, conscious, not you who brought the mosquitoes by thinking mosquitoes. So what was Yogananda talking about? He wasn't talking of mere denial. He was talking of generating a higher level of consciousness, on which level these things can't exist. For example, he used to say, and I'm just guessing now, but he used to say that every time somebody says an unkind word, a mosquito is born. In other words, mosquitoes are a part of the karma of this planet tied to meanness, unnastiness, biting, that sort of thing. And maybe what he meant then was that if you can really bring your mind to a level where you haven't that, then those mosquitoes can't touch you. An interesting thought. I don't yet know exactly what he meant when he said that, but I know that he meant something in tune with what I'm talking about. That you're putting out another kind of energy, whatever it is, that doesn't allow those mosquitoes to come back. And it isn't merely denying their existence. It isn't merely affirming that I'm well, for example, that makes you well. You've got to realize people who have overcome cancer have not merely denied their cancer. They have put out that kind of energy that cured it. If you want to overcome your destiny, you can't just merely say, I have no destiny, because you're strapped hand and foot by destiny, as long as you think blindly like that. But if you say, all right, I can overcome whatever by putting my mind up here, by putting enough of my energy out here, by uniting my energy with a greater energy of God and Guru and devotees on the path and so on, then you will see that indeed you are a free soul, that there isn't anything that you need to accept in this world, that you can pick and choose what will be good for you and what won't. There is no fixed destinies. There are certain alternative destinies that all of us have. You can't take on someone else's destiny, but you can redirect your destiny in keeping with who you are. So you can't become somebody else, but you can take of the various possibilities that you have, you can take them on different levels, and you can choose to take them on the highest level, and that will lead you out of even the worst karma into divine liberation.